Welcome to Scotuscast, Market Timing and Disclosure Requirements Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 27, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Gabelli v. Securities and Exchange Commission. The question in this case was whether, under 28 U.S.C. Section 2462, the five-year statute of limitations for the Securities and Exchange Commission to bring a civil penalty action against an investment advisor for securities fraud begins when the fraud occurs or when it is discovered. In an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held unanimously that the five-year time limit begins to run when the fraud occurs, not when it is discovered. To discuss the case, we have Ronald Colombo, a professor of law at Hofstra University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Colombo.
Hello, my name is Ron Colombo, and I'm professor of law at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. In this podcast, I'll be examining the case of Gabelli v. Securities and Exchange Commission, which the U.S. Supreme Court decided on February 27, 2013. The court's decision in Gabelli is an important one. The SEC had essentially argued that it was exempt from the statute of limitations when bringing a civil fraud claim against an alleged wrongdoer. A unanimous Supreme Court rejected this rather dangerous assertion in an opinion authored by Chief Justice Roberts. In these few short minutes, I will explain the factual underpinnings of Gabelli and will move on to a discussion of the legal issue decided, namely the statute of limitations question. In closing, I will offer some thoughts on the significance of the decision and its repercussions for the future. Let us begin with the facts of the case. To do this, we have to go back to 1999 and revisit the days of the market timing scandal that plagued the mutual fund industry back then. You may recall that this was a scandal brought to light in no small part through the efforts of New York's then Attorney General, Eliot Spitzer, later to become New York's governor, then infamously client number 9, and promptly thereafter, New York's former governor. Mutual fund shares are typically priced once per day, and market timing is an attempt to exploit certain opportunities that this practice enables. If, for example, a mutual fund's basket of securities includes some from overseas, it is possible, indeed likely, for those securities to move up or down well after a mutual fund's daily price has been fixed. A mutual fund market timer attempts to profit from this knowledge and take advantage of mutual fund pricing predicated upon stale information. To the extent that a market timer is successful in his or her efforts, the profits come, dollar for dollar, from other investors in the mutual fund. And whether successful or not, the frequency with which market timers trade typically runs up costs within the mutual fund, also to the detriment of other investors in the fund. For these reasons, market timing is generally frowned upon. That said, market timing is not illegal per se. The mutual fund companies got themselves into trouble by promulgating formal policies against market timing on the one hand, while at the same time allowing certain favored investors to secretly engage in it on the other hand. Hence, we have a misrepresentation. Hence, we have securities fraud. Gabelli Funds, LLC, allegedly did this very thing. As investment advisor to the Gabelli Global Growth Fund, Gabelli allegedly permitted one investor, Head Start Advisors was their name, to engage in market timing with regard to the Global Growth Fund. The incentive for allowing this was, according to the SEC, Head Start Advisors' agreement to invest in a hedge fund also run by Gabelli. So according to the SEC, from the period of 1999 to 2002, Head Start Advisors engaged in market timing in the Global Growth Fund with Gabelli's acquiescence. All the while, Gabelli represented to the world that it forbade market timing in its funds and would not tolerate market timing in its funds. Several years later, in 2008, the SEC brought suit against Gabelli Funds and two of its personnel, Bruce Alpert, the fund's chief operating officer, and Mark Gabelli, the portfolio manager of the Global Growth Fund. The SEC alleged violations of federal securities laws, all arising from this surreptitious allowance of market timing, and all sounding in fraud. Gabelli Funds settled fairly quickly for $16 million, Bruce Alpert and Mark Gabelli, on the other hand, insisted upon their innocence and fought the SEC in court. To get more specific, the SEC brought a civil action against Bruce Alpert and Mark Gabelli, setting forth the following claims. Alpert was accused of violating Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 of the 1934 Securities Exchange Act, along with Section 17A of the 1933 Securities Act. These are the two general anti-fraud provisions of these two acts. Mark Gabelli, along with Alpert as well, was accused of aiding and abetting violations of Sections 2061 and 2062 of the Investment Advisors Act. These two provisions make it unlawful for an investment advisor to, quote, employ any device, scheme, or artifice to defraud any client or prospective client, end quote, or to, quote, engage in any transaction, practice, or course of business which operates as a fraud or deceit upon any client or prospective client, close quote. As an investment advisor, Gabelli Funds was the entity in purported violation of Sections 2061 and 2062. The SEC alleged that Bruce Alpert and Mark Gabelli aided and abetted the fund's violation of these two sections. In terms of penalties, the SEC sought an injunction enjoining Bruce Alpert from violating Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 and Section 17A, and it also sought an injunction against both Bruce Alpert and Mark Gabelli, enjoining them from aiding and abetting future violations of Sections 2061 and 2062 of the Investment Advisors Act. It also sought disgorgement from Alpert and Gabelli for their ill-gotten gains. Finally, and most importantly for our purposes, the SEC sought monetary penalties against Alpert and Gabelli predicated upon their alleged aiding and abetting of Sections 2061 and 2062 of the Investment Advisors Act. In March 2010, the District Court in the Southern District of New York partially granted defendants Alpert and Gabelli's motion to dismiss. Of relevance to us was the court's analysis of Alpert and Gabelli's statute of limitations defense. The statute of limitations applicable to the SEC's civil action against Alpert and Gabelli can be found in 28 U.S.C. Section 2462. As its terms are fairly well laid out, I shall quote it in relevant part. Quote, except as otherwise provided by act of Congress, an action, suit, or proceeding for the enforcement of a civil fine, penalty, or forfeiture, pecuniary or otherwise, shall not be entertained unless commenced within 5 years from the date when the claim first accrued. Recall that the SEC's complaint alleged that the market timing fraud occurred between 1999 and 2002, more than 5 years before the SEC commenced its action against Gabelli and Alpert in 2008. For this reason, Gabelli and Alpert argued that the SEC's action was, among other things, time-barred. The district court agreed in part. The court was careful to distinguish between remedies sought that are punitive in nature versus those that are compensatory or injunctive in nature. Precedent had established that Section 2462 was applicable only to the former, not to the latter. Applying this dichotomy, the district court held that those claims seeking monetary damages were subject to Section 2462 as claims that were punitive in nature. But those claims seeking disgorgement and injunctive relief were not. As the SEC sought monetary damages with respect to its claims that the defendants aided and abetted violations of the Investment Advisors Act, these particular claims, and only these particular claims, were dismissed by the district court as time-barred under Section 2462. In reaching its decision, the district court rejected an argument pressed by the SEC that eventually managed to persuade the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. According to the SEC, even if Section 2462 applied to its Investment Advisors Act claims, the lawsuit could still nevertheless proceed. The SEC's argument was premised upon what can be called the discovery rule. The discovery rule is an exception to the general rule, or the standard rule, regarding the accrual of a cause of action for statute of limitations purposes. Recall that accrual is an important concept, as the 5-year limitations period set forth in Section 2462 begins to run from the date of a claim's accrual. Pursuant to the standard rule, a cause of action accrues when, quote, the plaintiff has a complete and present cause of action, close quote. And that's from a Supreme Court case from 2007. In other words, once all the elements of a claim or cause of action are in place, the claim accrues and the statute of limitations period begins to run. The discovery rule exception arose in the context of fraud cases. The exception was born of the recognition that in fraud cases, long times can sometimes pass before plaintiffs become aware of their victimization. By the time of a fraud's discovery, the statute of limitations could have completely run, thereby putting recompense out of a victim's reach. Thus, pursuant to the discovery rule exception, a claim doesn't accrue when its elements are in place, but rather when the fraud was actually discovered or when, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, it could have been discovered. Now, the Second Circuit hadn't considered whether the discovery rule exception should apply to Section 2462 in the past, but other circuits had, and they had rejected the exception. So the district court followed the suit, and they too rejected the exception. And it too rejected the exception. Nevertheless, as mentioned, when the issue did come before the Second Circuit, via an appeal in this case, the SEC's argument prevailed. The Second Circuit read the discovery rule exception into Section 2462, thereby creating a circuit split, which in turn precipitated the Supreme Court's granting of certiorari. In its short 11-page opinion, the Supreme Court expeditiously and unanimously dispensed with the SEC's argument. As the court explained, quote, given the lack of textual, historical, or equitable reasons to graft a discovery rule onto the statute of limitations of Section 2462, we decline to do so. Let's examine these potential reasons in turn. Textually speaking, the court noted that the term accrue has enjoyed a singular meaning in legal dictionaries from the 19th century to the present day. An action accrues and has always been deemed to accrue, quote, when the plaintiff has a right to commence it, close quote. The right to commence an action exists regardless of whether a plaintiff happens to be aware of it. Historically speaking, the discovery rule has been applied to protect aggrieved plaintiffs. As mentioned, its promulgation was in response to the situation where, and this is quoting from the Supreme Court, quote, a plaintiff has been injured by fraud and remains in ignorance of it without any fault or want of diligence or care on his part, close quote. The court added, it has never applied the discovery rule where the plaintiff is not a defrauded victim, but rather, quote, the government bringing an enforcement action for civil penalties, close quote. Precisely the situation raised in Gabelli. The court acknowledged one case on point in the past in which the government had successfully sought application of the discovery rule, but the court took pains to explain that in that particular case, the government had itself been the victim of fraud. Finally, the court turned to the equities of the question and here served up some embarrassing observations for the SEC. First, the court contrasted the situation of a plaintiff victimized by fraud with that of the government in general, and of the SEC in particular. It is understandable why a fraud victim might not so quickly uncover the fraud that ensnared him because, and this is quoting from the Supreme Court opinion, quote, most of us do not live in a state of constant investigation. We do not typically spend our days looking for evidence that we were lied to or defrauded, close quote. This is, however, exactly what the SEC has been created to do. Its central mission, the court said, is to, quote, investigate potential violations of the federal securities laws. And the Supreme Court took that nugget straight from the SEC enforcement manual. This mission is backed by a panoply of potent tools, from the SEC's heralded whistleblower programs to its broad subpoena powers. Further, the compensatory rationale that justifies the discovery exception for an injured plaintiff is missing in an SEC enforcement action seeking monetary damages. The weighty interests served by the statute of limitations cannot so readily be displaced when the objective is punitive versus compensatory in nature. The court considered the difficulty in administering a discovery exception that the government could lay claim to. How are the courts to ascertain what the government knew and when it knew it? Would knowledge by one agency be attributable to another? How would the thicket of governmental evidentiary privileges interact with such a rule? Finally, the courts spend a bit of time discussing the interests served by Section 2462 and of statutes of limitations generally. Memories grow stale and evidence diminishes in availability over time, which justifies setting an outer limit on the commencement of a lawsuit. Further, the value of repose is not to be underestimated, especially when the repose in question is with regard to federal law enforcement officials. Quoting Chief Justice Marshall, the court admonished that, quote, it would be utterly repugnant to the genius of our laws if actions for penalties could be brought at any distance of time, close quote. The court conceded that, in some law enforcement contexts, Congress has indeed promulgated statutes of limitations that expressly provided for the discovery exception. Thus, it is certainly not impossible to apply this exception to enforcement actions. That said, the court hastened to add that these contexts usually involve the government as a victim itself, thereby making these exceptions more equitable. Additionally, these statutes usually included an outer limit, an outer time frame in which suits could be brought as well, thus making repose ultimately available. This is not something that a judicially crafted discovery exception to Section 2462 would contain. For all these reasons, the court reversed the Second Circuit's opinion and remanded the case for further proceedings. As a result of Gabelli, it is now quite clear that the general statute of limitations rule applicable to government enforcement actions set forth in Section 2462 imposes a strict 5-year limitation period within which the government must bring its claims. The 5-year period commences when the claim is accrued and is not delayed by the government's failure to discover it. So what are we to make of Gabelli more broadly? Well, it certainly represents a powerful rebuke of the SEC. In the wake of the financial crisis, the SEC has been granted new powers and aggressive leadership. Gabelli fits well within a string of recent examples in which this newly emboldened SEC has been reined in by the courts. As the SEC has attempted to more vigorously oversee our nation's financial markets, the courts had to more vigorously oversee the SEC. At the same time, the SEC and other government agencies have been put on notice that they have to get their work done on time. 5 years really means 5 years. That's not a particularly short period of time, and certainly tolling agreements remain a possibility if an extension is needed. As the saying goes, justice delayed is justice denied. Perhaps we'll see less of both going forward as a result of Gabelli. In terms of precedent, for all its rhetoric, the Gabelli opinion must be recognized for what it is, a case of statutory interpretation. Nothing in the decision prevents Congress from amending Section 2462 to achieve a different result going forward, by, for example, adding a discovery exception to the text of the statute of Section 2462 explicitly. That could certainly be done. Nothing in the opinion prevents that. Further, the statute wasn't particularly opaque or difficult to render. It's notwithstanding the Second Circuit's holding on the subject. So when you couple that with its historical interpretation, it is not altogether difficult to see why this was a unanimous opinion. All that said, in light of the bold new regulatory era that America has entered, the decision shouldn't be underestimated either. At the risk of exaggeration, we live in a time when practically everyone, especially in the financial services industry, is probably in violation of something. This is something I'm personally acutely aware of each and every time I prepare my annual tax returns. I'm not certainly suggesting an epidemic of rash indifference to the law, but rather of inevitable oversights. There is simply a staggering amount of rules and regulations to wade through, and not all of them are entirely clear, and that's an understatement. And of course, even the most careful among us remains woefully imperfect. This creates an awkward situation for a people that cherishes its freedom and independence. The fear that if the government wants to, it could invariably nail you on something, no matter how careful and how law-abiding you've attempted to be. Couple that with the SEC's interpretation of Section 2462, and you really have a rather nightmarish scenario. Not only would the government, be likely to find you in violation of something were to look hard enough, but in addition, there'd be practically no time limit to how far back it could search. Thankfully, the Supreme Court has, at least for the time being, forestalled some of that. This was Ron Colombo. I thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.